This episode of AHLA Speaking of Health Law is brought to you by AHLA members and donors like you. For more information, visit AmericanHealthLaw.org.
Hi, I'm Norm Tabler with this month's edition of The Lighter Side of Health Law. Careful what you sign. Dr. Robert Ochoa has learned the hard way to be careful what he signs. He was in the ER one night when physician assistant Jose Rincon stuck a form in front of him and asked for a signature. He signed it, even though he wasn't Rincon's supervisor and hadn't treated the patient or even been asked to consult on her care. So he was surprised, even shocked, when he was later sued by the patient's daughter alleging that he was negligent for allowing mom to be discharged, resulting in a stroke the next day and permanent incapacitation. Dr. Ochoa responded that he was not mom's doctor and had nothing to do with her treatment or discharge. But the trial court and the appellate court ruled against him. Why? Because he had signed the form on a line labeled supervising physician, and the form contained the boilerplate statement, I agree with the assessment and care plan. So, the courts ruled, there is clear evidence that Dr. Ochoa had established a physician-patient relationship with mom. The case is Ochoa versus Avila, Texas Court of Appeals. How about an instruction that the doctor has to lose? Although I practice health law for decades, I have very little experience with trying Med-Mal cases. Maybe that accounts for my surprise at what the plaintiff wanted in this Virginia case. You decide. Kimberly Birch sued Dr. Jeff Sinsnick for malpractice after her mother died. She also sued several other doctors, but they settled. When the jury found in Dr. Jeff's favor, Kimberly appealed, arguing that the trial judge erred by refusing to give one instruction she requested and by giving two others she objected to. It's these three instructions that floored me. First, Kimberly wanted a, quote, empty chair instruction that the jury should be forbidden to even consider whether any person other than Dr. Jeff was negligent or contributed to mom's death. Second, Kimberly objected to the instruction that the fact that mom died did not in itself entitle her to recover. Third, she objected to the instruction that the fact that Dr. Jeff's efforts were unsuccessful did not in itself establish negligence. The appeals court ruled against Kimberly on all three issues. I'm surprised she didn't ask for an instruction saying, heads the doctor loses, tails Kimberly wins. The case is Birch versus Sinsnick, Virginia Court of Appeals. Is there an echo in here? Well, the latest development in the long-running Harvard versus Zurich insurance battle sounds a lot like some of the earlier rounds. You'll recall that Harvard racked up millions of dollars in attorney's fees in defending its affirmative action admission policy. When Harvard submitted a claim to Zurich Insurance, Zurich denied coverage, noting that Harvard was over a year late in notifying it of the suit. Harvard tried theory after theory, from we weren't required to notify you, to we did notify you, to okay, it was informal notice, but still notice, to hey, everybody knew about the case, to well, reporters notified you. But Harvard lost every round. Now Harvard has tried a new theory, suing its broker, Marsh, and arguing something like, poor Zurich was right all along and had no notice of the suit, knew nothing about it, and you know why? Because our crummy broker was supposed to do the notifying and failed to do it. So Marsh owes us our defense costs. Well, guess how Marsh responded. Marsh, like Zurich, says Harvard filed its suit too late, over a year after the statute of limitations expired. Stay tuned. The case is Harvard versus Marsh, District of Massachusetts. Reptile theory as trial strategy. Do you know what the reptile theory of trial strategy is? I didn't until I read about this Georgia Med-Mal case. When the jury came in with a $10 million verdict for Amy McGurk because of a botched gallbladder operation, the defense appealed, claiming that Amy's counsel had used the reptile theory as part of its trial strategy. What is the reptile theory, you're wondering? Well, it's a courtroom technique that tries to activate a juror's brain into a reptilian survival mode by suggesting that the defendants are a danger to the community and need to be punished to stop them. Well, the appeals court ruled that Amy's lawyer had done no such thing. He hadn't told the jury the defendants needed to be punished to prevent future harm, only that they needed to take responsibility for what they'd done to Amy. So now you know. The case is White versus McGurk, Georgia Court of Appeals. Sometimes a name says it all. A recent case of self-dealing by a state court judge in Alabama demonstrates yet again that sometimes a name says it all. In this case, the judge has been charged with self-dealing with public funds. The 18 self-dealing charges include spending public funds on a couch for himself, alcohol, eyeglasses, vacations including skiing, cycling, and beach trips, framing for his son's diploma and hiring said son for $10 an hour. The name of the self-dealing judge? Self. Yes, his name is Self. Gilbert Self. A new role for chatbots. We've all read a lot about using artificial intelligence, notably chatbots, for legal research and brief writing. Well, Air Canada has found a new role for chatbots, Fall Guy. The airline uses a chatbot for customer service questions. When a customer logged onto the Air Canada website and asked about bereavement fees, the answer was that he should purchase the tickets at full price and seek refund within 90 days. When the airline refused the refund, the customer produced a screenshot of the advice he had received. Oh, responded Air Canada, we're not responsible for that bad advice. You got it from a chatbot, which is a separate legal entity from us. Thanks for choosing Air Canada. What did the judge think of Air Canada's position? Not much. That chatbot, the court ruled, is a part of Air Canada's website. It should be obvious to Air Canada that it is responsible for all the information on its website. Air Canada has suspended use of the chatbot. Words that don't count. Appellate lawyer Mark Perry had a lot to say in his brief before the Federal Circuit Court of Appeals, so much that it exceeded the court-imposed word limit by some 1,300 words. That's when he had a crackerjack idea. Instead of putting the extra words in his brief, he would, quote, incorporate by reference the words in a brief in another case. Pretty slick, eh? Well, the opposing lawyers didn't think so. They cried foul. Mark did not respond, so the judge stepped in and demanded an explanation. Well, Mark explained, no court has ever expressly ruled that the word count includes words incorporated by reference from the same party's brief in a companion appeal. Plus, I've done you a favor by enhancing efficiency and streamlining the briefing. In other words, you ought to thank me for handling it this way. The court's response? Look, buddy, a word limit is a word limit, and Rule 28 and at least two decisions make it clear that you can't use incorporation by reference to beat the word limit. Also, how does it streamline anything or enhance efficiency when you force the court to cross-reference arguments from multiple briefs in multiple cases? Don't ever do that again. Mind your tongue. Well, it turns out that some of the words we've been using are hurting people's feelings. What words? Well, for one, non-lawyer. Yes, non-lawyer. A representative of the Stanford Center for Legal Informatics has started a formal petition calling on the ABA to ban the term. Why? Because, the petition insists, it hurts the feelings of non-lawyers to be called non-lawyers. So, what should we call non-lawyers? Well, the petition says, call them something they are, not something they're not. But what if, for example, you want to warn a client that the attorney-client privilege may be waived if a non-lawyer is in the room or on the call? If you can't call those unnamed people non-lawyers, and you have to say what they are instead of what they're not, do you have to list all the professions and positions of people whose presence in the room or on the line might cause a waiver of the privilege? Wow. Well, this makes me feel kind of dumb. It's not just that I've been using the term without knowing I was hurting anybody's feelings. It's also that for decades, I was often the, quote, non-physician member of hospital committees. And I was too dumb to know that my feelings should have been hurt by being called a non-physician. Complaint department. Zeros and O's. Here's another thing that bugs me. The confusion between zeros and O's. You run into it all the time. Take phone numbers. If a person has the phone number 48909, chances are he'll say it's 48909. But of course, that's wrong. There is an O on the phone dial or keypad. It's linked with the 6. 6 is MNO. So if you literally interpret 48909, you'd dial 48969. The confusion is mostly with phone numbers, but that's not all. Take the old TV show Hawaii Five-O. The O is there because Hawaii is the 50th state, but the second character in 50 is a zero, not an O. So it ought to be Hawaii 50. But the real problem comes in reading tracking numbers and model and serial numbers. It's always long and alphanumeric, meaning it has both numbers and letters, and the O's and zeros are almost identical. How do you know whether it's a zero or an O? Often you don't, so you don't know what to type in or read off. And here's something that proves to me it's one big conspiracy. Take a look at your computer keyboard. Notice anything funny about the placement of the O key and the zero key? That's right. One is right over the other. They could not be closer, and it couldn't be more confusing. Coincidence? I doubt it. If you have a complaint, send it to me. Well, that's it for this month's edition. I hope you liked it. I'll be back next month with another edition of The Lighter Side of Health Law.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to subscribe to AHLA Speaking of Health Law wherever you get your podcasts. To learn more about AHLA and the educational resources available to the health law community, visit AmericanHealthLaw.org.